Jena Clive Zammit, nishtiq nilqa s-semmija tal-Campus FM 103.7 għal-programmi ħor fis-sensiela għalfejn id-demokrazija. Illum il-programm sa jkun jitratta s-satira u r-rwol tagħha fid-demokrazija u miegħi illum għandi il-Prof. Michael Zammit, il-Michael Grech, għandna wkoll bħala mistiedna, żewġ mistiedna, il-Karl Stennin Ibarra u l-Sebastian Tantiburlo. Minħabba li wieħed mill-mistiedna tagħna huwa ta' oriġini da' xejn dubjuża, il-programm illum sa jkun bl-Ingliż, allura sa naqleb għal-lingwa Ingliża u minħabba li l-programm l-ewwel darba li sa jiġi rekordjat bl-Ingliż, nibda billi nintroduċi da' xejn il-programm għal dawk is-semmija tagħna li s-soltu ma jisimgħux ħabba li jkun bil-Malti. So I welcome our listeners to another episode in the program Alfein id-Demokrazija. I will start today with a little introduction of the program since this is the first time we are recording in English. First of all, today's program will deal with satire and its role in democracy. With us today I have Michael Zammit and Michael Grech, and also our guests today, we have two guests, Karl Stennin Ibarra and also Seb Tantiburlo. So just as a short introduction, for those listeners who don't normally follow us in Maltese, the program, as you know, is called Alfejn id-Demokrazija, and this translates well, loosely to why democracy, but maybe a bit lost in translation, in the Maltese, Alfein is also or can also be understood as where to or where for democracy. So this little play on words, in short, what we're asking in this program is where is democracy going, but also why do we choose democracy and why do we nurture it? We are asking this because as citizens of a democratic country, we tend to feel sometimes, and especially in these times, maybe a bit perplexed and not sure of what democracy is, maybe what's happening around us. So what we do in this program is we ask, we invite people from different sectors of Maltese society to try and understand better the process of democracy, the democratic process, try and understand what's going on around us, and maybe most importantly, how we can become more participative citizens in democracy and how we can nurture it and strengthen democracy. Today, as I think I've said already, we are going to deal with satire and we're going to investigate, together with the help of our two guests, the role of democracy, the role of satire in democracy, how satire helps democracy, and how it makes democracy stronger. Our two guests, I'll start with Karl Stennin Ibarra. As our viewers know, Karl Stennin Ibarra is Malta's number one journalist, who writes 50 articles a month, plus news in brief and photojournalism. Karl creates serious journalism on the satirical island of Malta. Karl is the managing editor of BS, we all know what that stands for, obviously Biserjeta, which is definitely Malta's best news source. BS has close to over 30,000 followers, which, we may remind our listeners, translates to nearly 6 or 7 seats in parliament had these been votes. So we can say that Karl on his own could be Malta's leading non-rubbish political party. We have also today with us Seb, or Sebastian Tantiburlo. Seb, as you know, is a political cartoonist and artist. Currently, he's stranded as well, like all of us, I guess, on the island of Malta. Seb graduated in architecture and urban studies from the University of Westminster, London. And his work combines current affairs, art, writing, and a splash of ink to create social commentary of today's times. So I'd like to welcome Karl and Seb to the program. And today with us as well, to help us technically, we've got Redent Abdullah helping us, keeping all this together, and maybe helping us also keep control of our guests and the little crowd that we have in here. But we start with a simple and simple does not mean that it's simplistic, I guess. question which I often ask myself, what exactly is satire? What forms can it take? We know that the two guests that we have with us, I guess, use different forms of satire. So separately, maybe starting with Carr, you can tell us a bit more what you think satire is, what it means for you, what it is, what form of satire you use, and then we can move over to Seb and he can give us his take and disagree with Carl, obviously.
Sure, yeah. Thank you for having me, Clive. I think essentially satire, you know, when you sort of break it down, is an opinion about society dressed up in irony and, you know, all sorts of other literary devices, shall we say. And it's, you know, it's saying something without saying it, which is something I've always loved, right, about it as a medium, as a style.
Right. So saying something by saying something else, or showing, yeah, something different.
Well, or showing it, like, you know, as you said, my medium is writing.
Right.
But, you know, it can take many forms. You know, Seb does cartoons, you have satirical films, and usually I would say, like, most of the time it's funny.
Right.
But not necessarily, you know, like, I don't know, something like George Orwell's Animal Farm is satire, uses analogy, which is one of the main tools that you use. Right. But, it's, you know, that's a commentary on, yeah, Stalin's Russia at the time. But, yeah, like, I focus on, like, the more funny, right, kind of the comedy satire, which I think is most satire, to be honest.
Right. Seb, anything to add to that? What is satire to you? Yeah?
Well, I agree with what, before I start, thank you for having us on. It's an honor to be with here as a guest with Carlos de Navarra. I'm a massive fan. I've been following his work for a long time.
Likewise.
Agreed. So it is, yes.
On the question of what is satire, I agree with everything that Carl has said. Simplistically put, I think it's poking fun at the powers that be, at anybody who, right, is in the highest echelons. Right. It is essentially an opinion piece. It is sort of digesting what's going on around us and distilling it into, again, in different ways. You have articles, you, yes, have memes, you,
right,
have cartoon, the traditional cartoon, film, as Carl said, distilling it into something that is impactful, that is humorous, is cutting, incisive, ridicules,
right,
can be very serious as well. So you can have all these overtones and undertones and different shades all merged into one image or one article that sort of puts a spotlight on a specific subject and tells the audience, okay, what's going on exactly over there? And with the injection of humor to sort of make it go down all the easier.
Yeah, I would agree in that, like, the humor is kind of like the sugar kind of with the medicine sort of aspect, yeah, of it. Yeah, but yeah, I would agree with that. It's sort of like holding a mirror up to society and saying, it's a bit weird, isn't it? Or this is absurd. This is
what you actually look like. This is what you're portraying.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
in reality, this is how you come off.
A mirror to society, but which is
like a funhouse mirror.
A funhouse mirror. That's right. A bit grotesque. So, it's satire. What should we call it? Is it a job, a mission? Is it something that you choose, or something that sort of falls into your lap somehow?
I don't know. It's a difficult one. That, like, I've always enjoyed comedy. You know, growing up in a half English, half Maltese house, and you know, I've always loved stuff like I don't know, Allo Allo, and like, which is, you know, that's sort of like, not, it doesn't have something like very intellectual to say about the world, but it's still sort of like, you know, it's a poking fun. And then you sort of end up graduating onto stuff like, so I think my first proper, like, exposure to satire was South Park, the cartoon.
Right. Okay.
So that was when I was a teenager. And then stuff like The Onion, which is obviously, that's satirical news. It's an American satirical news website, like probably the biggest in the world. And that's obviously where my main inspiration comes from. I don't know, like stuff like Douglas Adams, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah. I'd say those are my sort of my main inspirations. Yeah. And yeah, I've just always like... a friend of mine, a school friend, a schoolmate of mine, once said, "I have a talent for making fun of people." So I think it's always been sort of, you know, there.
Okay, careful what to say to your school, to your schoolmates.
Right. And Seb, what is it to you? Is it, was it a choice? Is it a job you've sort of taken on?
Well, I did the Maltese thing of going down the family business sort of. Because my father used to be the cartoonist, Morris Tantabrullo, for
of
the
course,
Times.
Of course.
That started in 1977 and sadly had to stop in 2014 due to illness that, that he had passed away from. And in 2014, when he was unwell, he had asked me, like, "Do you mind?" I never went to any art classes. My drawing was just things I picked up and sort of picked up along the way. So I was never trained.
Right.
And he asked if I could sort of fill in.
Right.
And obviously being brought up around around him, it was in me. Something like anybody. Anybody grows up with a lawyer as a dad, they start speaking in clausole.
Right, right.
And some weird Maltese Italian. So in my experiences it was quite innate. I knew how to poke fun at people, even though it took me years to hone in and to refine, even though my drawing skills are still a bit.
So you found you could cultivate this?
Yes.
Great.
And I also found it to be quite cathartic immediately that I had an outlet.
That's actually a very, very important issue, isn't it? In this program, we would like to examine a bit this exact issue, how what you two do actually helps catharsis in the democratic process in living in a country that needs to be civil or civilized. So do you see this? Do you see that what you do actually aids, helps that drive, this cleansing, this cathartic process, as you put it, Seb?
For me, I always found it immediately, if something annoyed me, I got to sit down on a blank page and draw. And I remember 2014, I'm going to use this as an example, Manuel Malia, because it was quite easy to draw, just a couple of spheres. sorry if I'm going to. It's also our job to offend, I suppose. So
absolutely.
And immediately I realized that this is what is the basis of it, is bringing this catharsis. So when you say a joke, laughter is this implosion of energy, no?
Yeah.
It's you join two opposing, juxtaposed ideas, and you result. You go from, I think Freud had said, like, when you say a joke, it is moving from A to Z, without going through any of the other letters. And once you arrive to Z, there's so much energy that you moved so quickly that it explodes in laughter.
Maybe you could stop a bit at B, but anyway.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, I think another element of comedy is, and I guess satire in particular, is surprise as well. It's something that people aren't expecting. And, you know, I guess even like now with social media, that's even more so because, you know, like you'll be, you know, scrolling Facebook and then sort of seeing stuff, headlines from The Times and Malta Today, Love and whatever. And then you just see this silly headline of mine. And for a second, you're like, oh, hang on a minute. Like that. And there are some people who think it's true, which is very amusing to me. And sadly, it doesn't happen as often as it used to, because I think people have gotten used to my writing and the you know, bizarre name. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely agree with Seb that it's cathartic, both for me. It's, I kind of see it as therapy for me, because it's like, it's better to, I have pretty much the same experience in that, you know, obviously rather than, draw, I just start writing or Photoshop something. And to be honest, the comments that I enjoy the most of people who read are the ones who say, like, you know, oh, you got me through a difficult time in my life, or like, you know, you help. I've got this from actual real journalists, where they'll say, like, oh, you know, like, because, you know, they spend the whole day reporting on real news, and then, you know, they
worrying
say, like,
about
it's,
it.
It's nice to come home and just read your take kind of on the whole thing. Michael.
Earlier, Sebastian said that it has, sorry, did I interrupt you, Carl?
No.
Okay. No, I'm just asking a question. Earlier, Sebastian said that satire is, I mean, pokes fun at the powers that be, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Michael added that it's sort of something cathartic with regards to, you know, those vibes which would make us more civilized, etc. So you make it sound like it's something very, very, very polished, very sort of kind of moral or what have you. But does satire have to, you know, can you have satire which attacks those who are not in power? So, for instance, I mean, the classic example would be the Nazi Der Stürmer, which attacked with basically caricatured both fun, etc., the Jews. But even with regards to the Charlie Hebdo thing, when you had the Charlie Hebdo incident, do you consider that satire if, I don't know, these target a minority which is ultimately powerless or have you? Or
yeah, the...
Does it have to have this moralistic high ground? That's what I'm asking.
Charlie Hebdo.
Can satire, be devious or?
Yeah, I think with everything, no, anything can be used for good or for bad, to put it simply.
So it doesn't need to attack. You can have satire which does not poke fun at the powers that be, but even possibly at weaker groups.
We've seen cartoons throughout history that have demonized and have ridiculed ethnicities, gender, sexual orientation. So any tool, a hammer, you're going to nail something in, or you're going to bash somebody's head in. You're going to use it in whichever way you're going to use it, and it's the user. It's up to the onus of the user to sort of apply those morals and those standards. Sorry, Carl, I sort of interrupted.
No, I was just going to say, Charlie Hebdo is quite an interesting and complicated, I guess,
very much so, yeah.
Example. Like, the thing I would say about Charlie Hebdo is, like, they get stick for, you know, poking fun at, you know, Muslims and Islam. But the thing is, they poke fun out of everything. And I think when you're kind of an equal opportunities, piss taker, I think if you're targeting one group, especially if it's a minority, that's not right. I would say in general, it's satire should be used to.
I beg to defer a bit with regards to Charlie Hebdo in 2010. They fired a cartoonist because he poked fun at the fact that I think it was Macron's son who had converted to Judaism. So,
yes,
this is one thing which I think is very important. Correct me if I'm wrong, mind you. So this is just my view. While it is important that I think satire desacralizes, pokes fun at anyone, I mean, the satirist will have his limits as well.
Yeah. I would just say that it's, in a way, I think it's kind of the satirist's job to test those limits and to see, you know, how far the line can go, and the comedian in general, I think. I totally get it. Like, there's my favorite quote from the founding editor of The Onion. As to the role of satire is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, which is something I kind of, you know, I believe in. You know, it's punching up, not punching down. satire. So as a general rule.
So in general, we're talking about the limits of satire. Obviously, satire uses all sort of grotesque, bad taste, you know,
my favorite
warped images of society, and also obviously of the different parts of society, different members of society. So the question then becomes, you know, where is the limit? Does satire have a limit? And I think Carl has pointed possibly at one limit is, you know, it shouldn't be used consistently or, you know, simply to, you know, attack one part or one minority in, but as long as it's, maybe this is the point I took here, that as long as it's being used to sort of push the limits in all sectors, and even some of those sectors could be minorities, then it's sort of fair play. Seb, do you see maybe some other limit or some other sort of, you know, no-go area for satire?
Well, again, because Carl and me work in different environments. So I work on paper, on a newspaper. So I have an editor. Right. So I have the newspaper sort of line I must tell,
mm-hmm.
Which very often I sort of, my line is very different to the newspaper's line.
So yes.
I've been weaned on, as called South Park, Simpsons, Gilray, the traditional cartoonists that in the 1700s, 1800s used to draw cartoons and be that are published as today are unheard of.
Yeah,
I agree that I think everything should be open to satire to a certain mm-hmm. extent, as a cartoonist. I am ready to poke fun at anybody who trumps into the room with obnoxious airs, be it from one party or the other, be he a private citizen who has just thrown himself into the public realm. I think that is one of the my golden rules, that everybody is open for, myself included.
Right.
I've often found myself at, I disagree with, not I disagree, I agree with Carl that satire should aim to punch up
right.
and never down. But sometimes you need to kick them in the shin and then run away.
Right, right. So we've often talked about, we've mentioned in different episodes of this program that democracy is a lot about equality, about, you know, every person, every single person having a vote and being equal in those senses and having equal human rights. And exactly. So in this sense, I think equality also works in here. We're all equally sort of potential targets for satire, and we shouldn't maybe think, oh, but why me, you know, or why is it, unless it is consistently me. On these lines, maybe I can ask you both separately, like, what does democracy mean to you, apart maybe from this idea of equality, and how does that tie maybe into satire? I'm driving at how does satire help democracy, and what would democracy be without satire? So,
I mean, democracy without satire would be, you know, an authoritarian, totalitarian country. You know, that's right. One of the hallmarks of, you know, somewhere like North Korea is that there's no right. dissenting voices. And that's the thing, like, satire is a dissenting voice, you know, and yeah, I think anywhere that it's one of the signs that a democracy is either absent or unhealthy in your country is if, you know, satirists are jailed or killed, you know. Democracy for me is, I think I would describe it as the fairest system we've come up with so far. It's obviously flawed, but yeah, until something, some alien race comes along, or we develop some kind of AI or something that can make decisions. It's probably the best we have.
The best of the worst.
You know, and in theory, because, you know, and then I would say democracy at the moment is a bit under threat and abused, shall we say.
Right, right. Yeah.
on shaky ground. It's imperfect. But that's the beauty of it, no? That it's always changing, that we can look at the bits that are broken and try and fix it. When we try and make a system that is, I know Stephen Fry recently like compared democracy to a spluttering car that sort of gets us along slowly. It's not a Ferrari. The Ferrari is like an authoritarian regime or a tank, right, which is a communist dictatorship. But it's this sort of beat up Citroën AX that has been handed down for generations, and you somehow manage to get to a place. It's also the beauty of the democracy is, if you manage, you get to overthrow a government every 4 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, if you don't like something, again, in theory, you can just every 4 or 5 years, you're like, all right, well, let's have another go.
And satirists right. basically highlight what there is that we maybe shouldn't like
yeah,
in the powers that be. Michael.
Clive, a few minutes ago, mentioned this thing about the democracy and equality, and both of you quite rightly said that there is a kind of equality in the sense that fairness in relation to the target. But the thing is that there is a kind of inequality when it comes to the people who produce the satire, in the sense that most of you are generally middle class, tertiary educated, etc. Is it that other people, for instance, who belong to the working class or who belong to other classes or who I don't know, to other groups which do not belong to our stratum of society, that they do not have access to either to produce satire, or if they produce satire, for instance, I can think of people who engage in Maltese folk singing. At times they do satirize, that this is not really taken seriously by the rest of society. What do you think? I mean, I'm just asking.
Yes, I agree that it comes from a middle class sort of educated people with a journalistic background or artists that have had training, and instead of just wanting to paint nudes, which I don't know why I never went into. I think it would be a bit more entertaining just to paint nudes.
Should submit one to the Times.
You get the vocation they want to use, their trade art, the drawing, to be part of the discussion. But I think memes today have become every man's cartoon, every man's satire. These pages, like, what's that one called? Carl, Malta Pastizzi Posting.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. As in, that's a pot full of satire, just generated by anybody who has a computer.
Of varying degrees of quality, we have to...
Yeah, but that's democracy as well.
Yeah.
Everything's of varied degrees of quality.
Right, so there's this democratization effect even of technology in terms of satire, that in a way, just like, as we say, anyone with a smartphone today can be a journalist, anyone with a laptop can be a satirist.
Yeah
pretty much. And, you know, I find it quite interesting how, like, because Seb mentioned, you know, at the end of the day, he has an editor to contend with. I just, you know, just publish whatever I want. As you alluded to, I do sometimes get comments with... you know, saying in bad taste.
Right.
I even made a T-shirt with that phrase on it.
We'll all buy one after this program.
Yeah, please do. The whole thing about, you know, offense and where to draw the line. I mean, at the end of the day, these are just words and cartoons. You know. I think, again, just to quote Stephen Fry, as Seb did, another quote from Stephen Fry, they're talking about offense and political correctness. Stephen Fry just says, like, so you're offended, so effing what?
Yeah. You
know? It's like, okay, what happens now? Like, okay.
Yes. So, I mean, we're talking about the skills, if you like, of producing satire or satire pieces. What about the skills is there some sort of skill or literacy in order to understand or to unpack satire, because as you said, you know, you can take it as, oh, these are just words or stupid pictures and very bad pictures, if you like, in bad taste and maybe badly drawn. But is there a particular skill that maybe we have or we lack or we need to maybe nurture more?
I think it always helps if you have knowledge of something when you consume it. You know, if you go into, I don't know, a Greek tragedy and you don't know the gods,
right,
you know, it's a lot of it is going to be lost on you. So there is a minimum requirement of literacy context needed and to get the references, you know, and context. Yeah, but I don't think satire is, at least what I do, and is, to the best of my knowledge, what Seb does, it's not particularly highbrow, you know. I would describe it as middlebrow. So I wouldn't say you need to be...
It's lowbrow.
Yeah, no, I would say low to middle, because, you know, some of the stuff I do, like, I'm just thinking about the image that I made that has got, I think, the most likes on Facebook was just, it was a picture of when the, a few months ago, when the Marsa bypass had flooded.
Right.
Not last week.
this morning.
of a few months ago. And I just did, it was a very simple, Photoshop. I just did like an arrow, pointing at the flyover saying fly over, and then another arrow pointing
swim
down,
under.
Swim under, exactly. Yeah. So that's very, you don't have to be a genius to understand that. Obviously, there's some stuff, you know, that especially the articles that you need to, again, not like a super, you don't need a university education to understand what I write, I don't think.
Right.
Might come in is that, especially at the, I mean, youngest ages, that we should teach students not to take themselves and not to take ourselves very seriously. That's, I think, the big problem. It's a question of attitude rather than
I would
understand.
That's a very big thing. And
Go on, Seth.
No, I was going to say, because you brought that Michael said that we should introduce students into not children not to take themselves too seriously, and to challenge teachers' ideas, which might become dangerous and unruly. But I also think we're never taught what democracy is as kids. In reality, we don't have these discussions. We're sort of born into it and we take it for granted.
Yeah,
I mean, when I saw the question, "What is democracy?" like the questions you had, I'm like, "What is this?" I'm sure there's a definition somewhere, but until you think about it, and it made me realize that it's a system that I've been brought up in and live in. So why did it take me so long just to connect, come to terms with what it is?
Yeah, I had the same problem looking at the questions as well. I'm like, I don't know. No, but I think a lot of people just think that, I think it's one of the biggest problems with democracy is I think a lot of people think it's, you know, you turn up every four or five years, you cast your vote, okay, bye, see you in 5 years' time.
Exactly, and as Seb is saying, I mean, we hit the ground running with regards to democracy. We're born into it, we're eventually meant to participate, we have democratic responsibilities as individual citizens, and maybe it doesn't come with an instruction book. And then it gets more complicated, you know, when we get satire and we don't know what is this? Is this trying to tell me something? Is this trying to help me make democratic decisions? Is this just muddying the waters? So on that point, we will give our listeners a short break and our guests a little break. And this time it will be a really short break. And we'll hear what Manu Chao has to say about satire in a satirical way.
Too much, too much promiscuity can drop to insanity. Said too much, too much insanity can drop to criminality. Say, oh, set me free. Whoa, let me be. Too much promiscuity can drop to calamity. Too
hypocrisy, can't drop to academy, too much morality, can't drop to criminality. Hypocrisy can drop to criminality.
Okay, so Seb, maybe I'll turn to you, because maybe with you this question is a bit easier. Who supports the satirist?
Not many people, but there are. But no, as in, the viewers support viewers and readers, people who digest it. Support. I find a lot of support from them.
Right.
I also find, I don't want to be too cheeky to my editors. They sort of go out of their way to make sure that traditional cartooning still survives,
right?
On print, because we all know that print is going out the window, and newspapers all over the world, their transition to online has been extremely painful and
right.
inefficient, and they haven't gotten their heads around it. So the old world media, which I am very tied to, because somehow you see a cartoon online is one thing, but when you see it on a newspaper right. in print, there's a difference. Maybe it's just me being sentimental about it. But I think the support that I find comes mainly from my viewers, from people who see the cartoons,
doesn't it usually come from the people who are opposed to whoever or whatever you're satirizing? I mean, it reminds me of Charlie Chaplin making fun of Hitler and being very popular in America, and then just a few years later being kicked out of America for making fun of America. So your audience is shifting
yeah.
all the time. That's an interesting point, because
the audience is fickle because they at one because, as we said before, a satirist, a comedian feels that everything is fair play.
Yeah.
If there's something wrong in one corner, you're going to point that out. If there's something wrong in another corner, you're going to ridicule that.
Yes, and really that should be the dynamic of a strongly working democracy, shouldn't it? I mean, there should be the availability to commit these shifts whenever necessary and when needed, rather than to have, like Sisyphus, push this, you know, the stone up the hill. Yeah. I mean, democracy should be liquid like that. So in satire, this liquidity is there, isn't it?
It is, until then, at a point, everybody hates you, because you've ridiculed everybody and nobody.
Okay, on exactly that point, Carl, who supports BS, actually?
As Seb said, it's the readers and the fans. I have a Patreon page, and people can subscribe, become literally patrons, because that's
right.
where the Patreon, you know, it's right. sort of based on the idea of, you know, in the, you know, Renaissance times, an artist would have a pope or a
right.
or a merchant or whatever, you know, backing them. And that's kind of like the idea of that. I'd like more people to to be patrons. Advertising is tricky. Because obviously the controversial nature of what I do, you know, there are a handful of businesses that are a bit more keen than others, but it's still a difficult ask. So it mainly has to come from readers, and sort of they're the ultimately what will decide whether Biserita stays around or not,
right,
really.
Right. And how long has Biserita been going?
So my first article was in 2011. It was about it was when Prince William and Kate Middleton had got married,
right.
And I'd written an article saying that the Queen had given Malta the whole of Malta right. as a wedding gift because she didn't know that it was still she thought it was still a colony,
right?
And yeah, that's how it started. And I guess that was, I suppose you could say, a commentary on colonialism, whatever, right. you know, but it was mainly sort of
right.
This is the thing, like, there's always some articles are sillier than others, and some of them, you know, have more of a point that I'm trying to make. And then, yeah, that carried on. And, you know, and then what helped with it at the time was the divorce referendum. That was fantastic for Basiria. Well, like, whenever there's something controversial, that's great for me.
Right.
So, yeah, just it's better for Basiria if things aren't great. Right. And then
you're
I had
great. You don't have anything to do.
No, exactly. You know, I'm writing articles about parking and traffic, which are fun, but. Yeah.
So, Seb, have you seen any trends with regards to the uptake or, you know, the support towards satire? I mean, is the public, you know, getting more into satire, less into satire, or maybe more opposed to satire? What sort of, are there any trends that one can sort of identify? And
I think, like everything else, everything's becoming a bit too polarized. So we saw in the States, the New York Times has cancelled all their cartoons.
Right.
They don't publish any more cartoons.
Have they?
There was that Canadian cartoonist, the Adler, I can't remember his name exactly, Michael the Adler,
mm-hmm.
Who was dropped by his newspaper for drawing a cartoon on Trump.
Right.
So people are getting offended way, way easier today.
I don't feel like that. Sorry to interrupt you, but I don't feel necessarily that I hate to use the word for the phrase, but cancel culture has really arrived in Malta, really.
No, I don't think it has. So in fact, I was trying to be like, there's this one side of society that as soon as you poke fun at them, they get so offended that they want to try and cancel you.
Right.
Yeah, I think has always been so. We're,
yes.
As a nation, we're quite sensitive, so immediately, like as soon as you as is the rare time you actually manage to hit that nail on the head, the amount of people that sort of get offended and sort of go against you is disproportionate to the amount of people who try and support you.
Yeah.
May I ask? Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, may I ask a bad question in this regard? Could it be that cancel culture hasn't arrived in Malta because ultimately the powers that be, they don't see you as a threat?
Yeah, I suppose. When I said you know, cancel culture hasn't arrived, and then sort of as soon as I said it, I was like, oh, wait, no, it's because it's always been in Malta, which Seb then pointed out.
Yeah.
But it's yeah. I mean, just look at, you know, the stuff like, I don't know, the whole Mark Camilleri business, where, you know, the sort of like in Malta, I think the sort of the default to someone, you know, I get messages, for example, saying that, like, by people who don't like an article or who were offended, they're like, take the article down. I'm like, no. You know, it's this thing of like, people think they have a right to sort of, just because they don't like something, they can sort of say, no, I don't like that, take it down. Not even a please, incidentally. so, yeah, it's...
That's it, as in we operate in our own world, in reality. Malta has its own parameters that, although similar to other places and other countries, it's its own sort of...
Yeah, sort of a microcosm, I guess you could call
it. I forgot what I was about to say. Something. It was about support. And Michael brought up, what was the question again?
No, if there isn't that culture, cancel culture, because
we're not threatened. We don't threaten.
Yeah.
Well, to be frank, why should the most powerful people be threatened by a poncho wearing middle class white boy who just throws ink at a page? If they are threatened by me, they have serious problems.
Yeah. Not threatened by you, but by the effects of your words. Yeah. But that sort of makes it a bit. I mean, what you're saying might be the case, but that makes it, I think, a bit tight. The finale of the program becomes a bit, I don't know, melancholic, sad, whatever. It means that ultimately you try to send...
No, because they do get offended. They are threatened. The people in power do, as soon as they see an article written on Bisserietta, or one of my cartoons. It still surprises me, like, the amount of times I get... somebody would send me a message, as Carlo saying, like, you shouldn't have drawn that. How dare you draw that person in that manner? So yes, somehow they feel that we are threatened. We do threaten them, especially, like, I don't know. I was in Overdrive last year when there were the protests going on.
Same.
We're churning out. I mean, for me, it was like just working. And I do think in that situation it consolidated and grouped people together.
Yeah.
It's also a sort of banner for people to be like, okay, this guy is taking the piss out of this minister who you shouldn't be because everyone's scared of them. But if somebody realizes, if this guy can do it and they haven't locked him up for doing it, then maybe I should be a bit more brazen with the way I interact with democracy.
Right. Mm. So the way I'm sort of hearing you is that there isn't really much pressure for self-censorship. It's like you don't feel like it. Is that right? Or
again, it depends, because if I'm on the newspaper, I self-censor myself a lot.
Right.
Because I'd be drawing asses and every other orifice that I could imagine and be putting heads in them.
Right.
And obviously the readers of the Times would probably have a heart attack. The majority of them are over 89. So when it comes to the Times, I do sort of toe their editorial line, which for me is self-censoring.
Right.
Then when I come to post my own cartoon online, there's a different type of self-censoring that I'll go through. I'd say, have I gone overboard? Does it make sense for me to draw this? And I don't really believe that there's something too offensive, but would the message get lost in the vitriol of my drawing, in the grotesqueness of my drawing, which very often it does?
Right.
So I have that inner dialogue with myself for self-censorship. Otherwise, all you'd be seeing are assholes everywhere.
Right. So, Carl, I don't see this sort of self-censoring in your work. Or is it there in maybe a more subtle way? Or is there, in other words, a limit of bad taste which even you would maybe shy from?
I would say that my line when writing is, so the question I ask myself is, who am I targeting? And for me, like anyone in particularly in the public eye, especially politicians, totally fair game.
Right.
I mean, aside from that, yeah, it's like, Seb said, sort of like, is this too much? It tends to be the ones that are like, you know, where I'm going into sort of the shock comedy. And I would definitely say that I do have ideas that I don't actually publish. It's also whether it's funny. That's my ultimately my thing. My deciding factor is this funny? Is this funny? Is this targeting the right people?
Right. Yeah. So you don't feel a pressure in the sense of, look, we're not democratic enough, or sort of we're not open enough or liberal enough to take this, or that this will, you know, have consequences. It's more a question of, you know, who it's going to hit and the comic effect,
yeah,
in a way.
Well, we're seeing right now the consequences, as in there have been two rulings by a judge on satire,
right.
An actress who was in the play Allo Allo. In that situation, I sort of sideways understand the ruling.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't the show. It was a photo of the actress who was put up on social media. So there's a lot of legal jargon where, all right, that was justified. But in the case of Carl now, that is a very dangerous precedent.
Right. So you see sort of a danger with regards to democracy, and you feel it in your line of work that you sort of have to, in a way, be careful where you tread or not. How dangerous is this for democracy?
Yes, I think we've been going through internationally and locally a very rough patch in democracy, as in locally we've seen the judiciary, all the institutions that are meant to be independent from the state, sort of aligning themselves, let's put it that way, to be politically, to dance the line, aligning themselves too closely with the state, which makes it very difficult for dissenting voices to be heard or even to be spoken.
Yes.
They made it quite dangerous.
Government, not the state, because they are part of the state.
Yeah, yes. You're right, sorry. A trivial story. I was walking down the street once in Valletta and somebody called out my name. I didn't know the person. I turned around. They started attacking me. And then I just sort of shrugged it off and walked off. The guy clubbed me in the back of the head.
Oh.
So there is, but would that be, I mean, all right, Michael made, you know, this distinction. Would you say that's a result more of the state or of our sort of tribal partisan politics mindset that, you know, we're...
I don't think it's unique to us because we've seen it happen in other countries. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think our tribal political atmosphere does help it.
Right.
Like roll down the hill. I don't use excuses that our tribal background has brought us to this situation.
And
it's only us who can extricate us from it.
Right.
No, I was going to say, I think at the end of the day as well, the political parties encourage this tribalism, so you can't say it's like, oh, this is the people's fault,
right.
Because once it's
encouraged,
it's encouraged, it's fomented, it's you know, it's for their benefit.
But I think it's a bit simplistic to simply blame the parties, Carl. Encourage as well, but I mean, in a country where 95% of the people vote, most of them vote for either of the two tribal parties, where you are not forced to vote. I mean, you wouldn't pay a fine if you don't vote, whatever. Yeah. I think it's a bit, the two feed each other.
Yes, I mean, ultimately,
feed each other.
Ultimately, people vote. We vote for these people, so,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The snake.
That's I think, could be a huge role that you may, or you do actually have, that maybe you try to be kind of infiltrate within this vicious circle and try to induce people, or a good number of people, to...
Right. I will leave you with the last question and ask now, as taking the point from Michael's intervention, looking to the future, what would you say would be the you know, most important change or the thing you would wish to see different in Maltese politics, and maybe the way satire is done or taken up? If you had to have a magic wand, in other words, you know, where you could wave it and change one thing, Seb, would there be anything that you would say, wow, this would really make things better for me, for the country, for, you know?
Well, I think better paid journalists would help along. Honestly, that's a question that's sort of stumped me. because I sort of deal with the here and now in cartoons, right, and satire. Sort of this is the muck and mire I'm dealing with, and
right,
maybe I should start thinking about where do we want to go from here? I don't know. As in today's society, I would like to be that we don't have this tribal politics anymore, and that dissenting voices are cherished and maybe not cherished, because then you don't become a dissenting voice anymore.
Right.
But respected, other than vilified. We've seen what happened, right? Right. As in, we saw what happened to Daphne Caruana Galizia.
Carl.
I would say it all comes down to education. Because if you teach people at a young age that, you know, it's not all about red and blue, and there is a lot of gray in between, then you will end up with a more critical population. And I wish, as in something I wish would happen right now, I guess it's for people, particularly writers, musicians, etc., to be less afraid of expressing themselves.
Thank you. And with those words, we'll have to end the program for today. I thank once again Michael Zamit and Michael Grech and Carl Steninbara and Seb Tantibollo for helping us understand democracy a bit better and the role that satire plays in our democracy.
Thank you for having me.